Thank you, Jason, for that introduction. Thank you to the Philadelphia Society for having me. It's always delightful to be back amongst my friends. American conservatives are rightly chagrined at the direction of their country. The parade of horribles that we currently witness is perhaps too long and too familiar to recount. Matthew has mentioned some of them. One response to this parade has come from a handful of what I'll call theological political thinkers known as integralists. Some would embrace that label, others merely travel in the orbit of integralism. And I'm not going to get too far into the weeds of a definition of this phenomenon because it's very much a moving target and no definition is likely to satisfy all or even most listeners, I think. I'll instead characterize some of the major sources of disquiet shared by many integralists and their fellow travelers. And in the course of doing that, I'm going to highlight some similarities that I see between contemporary integralism and early 20th century Christian progressivism, ironically, or perhaps not so ironically. Integralism American style, like the Christian progressivism before it, comes to sight as a critique of the American constitutional order. It sees this as the apotheosis of Lockean liberalism. And it's this Lockean liberalism, or so the critique goes, that is the genesis of many, if not all, bad things in our public life. In short, a republic of individual natural rights cannot support a conception of the good life or a politics of the common good. Integralists see the U.S. Constitution as the embodiment of a set of modern principles that sought to overturn ancient teachings and shape a distinctly different human being, steeped in rights but freed from obligations. Liberal politics, economics, education, and science are each oriented toward liberating the self from the constraints of custom, culture, and nature. In this sense, for the integralists, the project of early modern classical liberalism and late modern progressive liberalism is the same. Liberalism as a whole amounts to a politics of the self, a comprehensive anti-culture, to quote a contemporary political theorist. The integralist goal is to liberate us from this modern project. The path to liberation is through a rather powerful state, one that adheres to Christian and especially Catholic faith and social teaching. Integralists can therefore find no real alliance with constitutional originalists, both because they think the Constitution is tainted by the original sin of liberalism, but also, somewhat inconsistently, I think, that the Constitution is open-textured enough to allow strong men within the executive branch and the administrative state to pursue a politics of the so-called common good. Go for results, they counsel. Don't try to recover constitutional principle. Where has that gotten us? The integralists would ask. When the fullness of time was come, God sent the administrative state. Even federalism, as a matter of principle, must give way to the judgments of those who would rule us in the name of the common good. Instead of federalism, they would rule us, one assumes, by leaning on some not quite worked out version of subsidiarity. But to lean into this just a bit, I for one would not wish to live through another, let's say, public health crisis wherein only the judgment of common good rulers stood between me and the clutches of the national state, without the legal pushback of local and state authorities. Even given how attenuated that was from 2020 to 2022, it was still better than nothing. My own county in the wilds of western Pennsylvania was, on the whole, a quite tolerable place to live in compared to many other places, more under the thumb of those who preached precisely about the common good and our obligations as citizens. Or more generally, I would not wish to live in a land where I could not vote with my feet because there'd be nowhere else to go. Admittedly, we're already pretty far down that road, but I think integralist understandings of politics promise to take us even further. To quote the great political philosopher and poet of the American regime, Kid Rock, wear your mask, take your pill. Now a whole generation is mentally ill. It should be noted that common good constitutionalism renders written constitutionalism nugatory, just as progressive living constitutionalism did before it. There is, after all, no point in having a written constitution if it's simply an empty vessel into which the concoctions of the ruling classes may be poured, if its terms are malleable enough to support the non-consensual rule of elites. Let's compare all this for a moment and in just a little more detail to the Christian progressives, both Catholic and Protestant, of a century or so ago. They too mobilized intellectually and politically against the purported inadequacies and injustices of the Founders' Constitution and the modern economic order as a whole. And they did so with a fervor for and faith in non-consensual expertise, which they thought could remedy injustice. And the intensity and fervor of that faith could be traced to their religious impulse. Throughout the Progressive Era, religious language was common at political gatherings, including even national conventions. The Progressive Party Convention of 1912 adopted Onward Christian Soldiers as its anthem. Teddy Roosevelt compared the upcoming campaign to Armageddon, and the Bull Moosers insisted that they would do battle for the Lord. But the fervor of Christian progressivism was unlike that of prior American religious awakenings. Instead of concentrating on individual moral failings and the need for individual reformation, Christian progressives, like integralists now, I think, concentrated their gaze much more on matters of social justice and economic justice. By the first decades of the 20th century, both Protestant social gospelers and Catholic reformers were vigorously attempting to shift the center of gravity of American politics and mainline Christianity toward, you know, applying a Christian ethics in the here and now. The real presence of Christ came to take on a whole new significance. Progressive theologians began to point to what they claimed was the essentially social and political nature of the Christian enterprise. For example, Father John Ryan, in his 1906 book, A Living Wage, and this, by the way, like his Protestant counterparts, sought human solidarity and heavenly justice through economic policy. And in this quest, he sought to turn Catholicism, as the social gospel had turned Protestantism, against the American system of constitutionally limited government, private property, and capitalism, all in the quest for a more rational, scientific state that would support something like the kingdom of God on earth. Ryan was no particular friend of self-government, and he insisted that monarchic or aristocratic forms could claim legitimacy depending on circumstances. The state should ideally recognize the one true religion, that is to say, that professed by the Catholic Church, and prevent the introduction of new forms. He allowed that Catholic states wherein other denominations are already established should generally tolerate them as a matter of prudence, but no rights are absolute in the sense of being ends in themselves, including freedom of conscience. All aspects of the state should be understood to be the means to human welfare. And so Ryan leaves to the good judgment of Christian rulers vast amounts of discretion as to what constitutes public welfare, even in matters of conscience. All these theologians, it's fair to say, came to de-emphasize the idea of helping oneself as the key to both personal prosperity and to becoming functioning moral agents in a stable society. They also took little account of the problem of scarcity, or that government economic mandates are often exclusionary rather than inclusionary. For example, they favor those who are already employed rather than those who seek employment. Administrative rules exclude, monopolize, and stratify. The roots of the modern administrative state and confidence in the power of elites thus run deep in the soil of Christian progressivism, I think, as contemporary integralists now seek to use that state for their purposes. To the extent a secular millenarianism is evident in the rhetoric of contemporary liberalism, it can trace its origins to the rather insistent piety of early progressive religious thinkers. In short, to understand our political moment, one needs to take religion more seriously than many historians have been prepared to do, but fortunately this conference is doing. Christian progressives joined forces with economists like Richard Ely and political scientists like Woodrow Wilson against what they claimed were the new economic and social realities that had been fully unleashed by the modern economic age. Christian progressive thinkers pressed for an expansion of state power, especially national power, at the expense of constitutional limits. And in the case of the theologians, it was also at the expense of the sacred, even as the essential rituals of Christianity were still important to them. Theirs was a natural law or theological diktat that did not limit government in principle, but rather helped ensure its protean expansion as it reduced Christian faith to a set of economic and political demands. Compared to the early Christian progressives, the integralist vision is, I think, even more comprehensive, less defined, economic statism being only one aspect of it. Almost no major facet of the modern world escapes the withering gaze of the integralists. Education comes under attack for ensuring that its student products have no real choice. that they are prepared only for employment in a deracinated global economy where workers are fully alienated from their labor. Liberal science, they claim, rests on the shifting sands on which it was originally built by the likes of Bacon and Hobbes, dedicated to human control of the human and non-human environment, undermining the possibility that we might recognize, let alone submit, to obligations beyond human control. And making a Tocquevillian point, they see individuals as becoming increasingly atomized and their connections to alternate sources of authority attenuated, thus becoming the playthings of the political sovereign, which ironically wears the label limited government. Unsurprisingly, some integralists are monarchists, Catholic monarchists. Some have expressed to me personally in no uncertain terms a desire to return to the politics of the medieval world. Others are more circumspect. But they are, it's fair to say, men without a country. A strong vein of authoritarianism, evidenced perhaps by impatience with critics who seek clarity, seems to run through integralism. Integralism is often identified as a species of political conservatism, although it's hard to know in what sense. In fact, it's very radical in its rejection of both America and the Enlightenment in toto. Furthermore, it goes rather too far in reducing modern political thought to the false anthropology of self-creation. Defining, nay, reducing liberty to complete freedom to pursue one's desires is unfair even to the philosophical originators of modern liberalism and a fortiori to the American founders who were morally grounded statesmen, not philosophers. The founders understood the consenting individual to exist in an obviously political sense. That is, no man is so naturally superior to another to be entitled to rule the other without his consent. This rests not on a dangerous voluntarism or radical individualism, but on a recognition of moral, political, and theological reality. Certainly, none of the founders believed in unfettered autonomous choice. Instead, they believed and acted as if they believed in self-government, which presupposes the taming of the passions through custom and law. A century after the founding, it was American progressives, far from being of one mind with the founders, who wrote voluminously against what they saw as the founders' anachronistic natural law thinking and against the Constitution that was its product. Without question, modern liberalism is a target-rich environment. But so is the integralist's alternative. Ultimately, it is their human anthropology that is false, borrowing from, yet at the same time masking or distorting, Christian doctrine, including Christianity's insistent universalism and its recognition of what stands in the way of God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. Not all sin is social, much less is it Lockean or particularly American. After all, the impulse toward autonomy and mastery long predate modern political philosophy. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. To quote Dostoevsky, the fire is in the minds of men, not in the roofs of the buildings. Modernity, and especially its American variant, did not seek to unleash the dangerous passions that constitute the soul, but to tame them through new modes and orders. Integralists would unleash them again in accordance with their gods. They could pause to reflect a little more on an American Enlightenment thinker. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Limitations on government are unnecessary only if that fixed conception of human nature, that men are but men, as they were in the beginning, is rejected. And for this rejection to appear plausible, both reason and revelation must be dramatically reconfigured. We certainly don't get to the common good merely by exhorting a politics of the common good or engaging in an unending critique of market liberalism. After all, meddling in the affairs of others in the name of pursuing social justice or the common good or doing God's work nowadays tends to be undertaken by philosophical, theological, and political incompetence, or worse. But thus has it always been. Theologically speaking, we are embodied individuals. Any decent political order must take account of this. The individual and the rights he has by nature cannot be sacrificed on the altar of an ill-defined common good. The question is always, how might we best prevent this? But perhaps the greatest threat in all of this is to Christianity itself, which ultimately works through love, not force, not politics. It can only flourish as itself when conscience is free to choose it. In the words of one of the great founding members of the Philadelphia Society, we are at the deepest level free to choose. God made us so. No single confession of faith in the American context is possible or desirable. Over such a thing, there will be blood. The integralist vision seems to require conflict. Finally, the early progressives did not evince much real concern that the church would not purify politics, but be corrupted by politics. And I think integralists, too, do not worry about this as much as they should. But in concentrating as they do on social sin, they are perhaps excused, like their progressive forebears, by two facts. They do not understand Christianity, and they do not understand politics. Thank you.